listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 170 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner. Joining me on the other side of the country is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
Good. I'm doing a first for our podcast right now, which is I'm recording without a shirt on.
What?
Yeah, it's super hot here, and because I'm concerned about road noise that's happening on my street, I've got all the windows closed. I'm on the second floor. All the hot air is coming up here. So,
wow.
This episode is going to be hot.
Little do the listeners know, I've always recorded without a shirt on.
Yeah, well, no. I'm just peer pressure. I finally
jumped. I know. I am at the CD Baby office, and I am fully clothed. So,
besides that, though, this for me has been a week of music video premieres. I premiered 4 different videos this week.
I've been noticing that.
It's kind of overload, I think, but
how's it been going?
Good. Let's see. Performer Magazine did one that was a cover song video, and Pop Matters today premiered a video from a song on my new album, and then I did 2 lyric videos as well at Ghetto Blasters and Nuga.com. So yeah, each day has been a new premiere.
Excellent. Excellent.
And since this is a podcast about music marketing, I think I would say don't do 4 in 1 week. Spread them out.
See, you're sharing instant feedback.
Real-time advice.
Real-time advice.
I mean, for one, it's kind of daunting for me to keep track of and on top of. And then I think I'm also burning out and confusing my audience, like, because if I say, hey, new video premiere, like, and they see it on Facebook, they might think, yeah, I already watched that yesterday.
That's true. I probably would have recommended 1 a week for a full month.
Yeah.
But you didn't ask for my opinion, so.
Well, no, and honestly, that's what I was kind of hoping for, but my publicist was lining them all up, and it's sort of the way it shaked out. So
okay, I see. Well, that makes sense. I don't know that I have anything else going on. I still can't get past the whole podcast. I'm gonna have this image of you without a shirt on. So that's just blown all sorts of concentration of. But we have some good things to discuss. By the way, our last episode 169 with Kathy Heller is getting rave reviews. Lots of comments in the comments section. Several people said it's the best interview I've done out of all 169 episodes. It is definitely a good one with lots of real details about how to license your music. So if you haven't heard that episode, you should definitely go back and check that one out, because I was taking tons of notes and look forward to listening to it again myself, because trying to get some sync things happening for some things in our musical catalog. So check out that episode.
Well, it makes sense, too, because you've had a lot of interest in that subject for a long time, and you did some sync licensing work for CD Baby, and it's kind of your area of, well, one area of expertise for you. So I guess you know the right questions to ask.
Yeah, so it was good. I think I pulled a lot out of her that in other interviews might have just been glossed over, but I wanted to know the real details, like what she says, who she's talking to, all those things. So you can find that in episode 169. In today's episode, we are going to be discussing how to deal with criticism, or how to deal with a bad review, all those things that happen no matter what. When you're creating art and putting it out in the world, someone's not going to like what you're doing, and they're going to be happy to tell you about it, too. So we're going to talk about that later on in the podcast, but we do have some news items, so let's get to the news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Will the download be dead by 2020? Single track download sales in the U.S. have dropped by 42% since their peak just 4 years ago, sparking the real possibility that they could become a dead format within 5 years. In the first half of 2016, single track download purchases plummeted by 24% year over year, falling by 127.3 million sales compared to the same 6 months in 2015. If the U.S. download market continues to see that level of sales decline each year, music purchases on stores like iTunes would be rendered non-existent by 2020. According to historical Nielsen figures, 2016's haul of 404.3 million U.S. download sales was down 42% over 2012's peak tally of 698 million downloads. So it's down 293 million downloads. But that shouldn't surprise us with this next story that 15 through 19 year olds don't care about owning music. According to market research company Loop, 15 through 19 year olds in the US overwhelmingly prefer to listen to music through an on-demand streaming service. That includes YouTube as a predominant source, with Pandora, Spotify, and other streaming services also on the list. By contrast, formats involving ownership of content, including downloads, are plummeting in importance. The research was published with the Music Business Association and claims that for this age group, on-demand streaming accounts for 51% of daily listening. The rest is made up of downloads, files at 20%, AM/FM radio at 12%, and internet radio at 9%. So there is good news. Spotify has hit 37 million subscribers. The Swedish streaming service is currently standing around 37 million subscribers, a figure accelerated by a recent price promotion in multiple territories. For the past quarter, Spotify has been targeting new free users with a Love Your Summer promotion, offering 3 month subscriptions for just 99 cents in the US, as well as offering lapsed subscribers a $9.99 for 3 months deal. So, lots happening with the shift of the music business. Downloads declining, 15
yeah,
through 19.
No big surprise, and I feel like we might bore our listeners if we yet again spend time talking about how much you and I hate managing MP3 files. But
you know,
it's true.
I was about to throw my phone and iPad against a wall because the promise of a seamless experience that I was promised for years, I've been lied to. And I can't access my music catalog. And it's frustrating. And this came about because I was using an app I very much love to use to practice guitar. It's called Jam Up Pro. It has some great audio amp modeling options in there that sound really cool. And you can import MP3 files to play along with. You can speed them up, you can slow them down, you can change the key. So if you have to learn some tracks, it's a great tool to be able to import some tracks that and play along with and figure it out. And I could not access my music catalog. It would not import the MP3s, even though it was those files were on that device. And then I go to Apple Music and I'm saying my catalog and it's all jacked up. It's just a nightmare. And to me, the frustrating thing is it's like I feel like the decline of the download is partly due in the fact that these companies have just made it impossible to use it. So it's not like I feel like anyone really even has a choice at this point.
Yeah, I still am confused about what songs I have stored on my phone at any given moment. Like, and then, you know, you plug your phone into your computer and suddenly things are syncing when you don't want them to. It's total nightmare.
Yeah. And Apple announced a couple weeks ago that they're going to be, you know, refreshing Apple Music. I was hoping that it would just be hey, today you can now download a new Apple Music, but it's not available. It'll be available in the fall as a part of a new iOS, which was kind of disappointing, and the features they showed really didn't improve it all that much. I mean, they didn't show it much. In my opinion, it was one of the more lackluster, wackier presentations by by Apple. They had someone who was trying to get the audience to dance for that segment. I'm like, you really have nothing to show if that's what
they
you're
need
trying
to do a song and dance routine.
Yeah. So they are creating a download section where it's supposed to better account for the things that you've purchased and downloaded. But still, it's such a nightmare and just trying to manage among these devices. And I feel like the people that are supposed to be making this easier have actually decided to make it harder. And that's partly killing the download market, because there's certain things that I would have kept buying, but it's like, I don't want to mess with this anymore. I buy it and I don't get to listen to it. I end up using the streaming service anyway. So that's my frustration with it. I know we are moving to a streaming economy, but my frustration is that it wasn't just because fans decided that that's what they wanted to do. It's because the device folks had made it so hard that it's just not worth people's time to try and buy music.
Yeah, and as a personal anecdote that I think bridges all of these news stories, the other night we were rearranging a room in our house, and we realized we needed to buy a new vinyl player. And so we went online and we were searching for a record player. And I just thought, wow, isn't it amazing? Like, my listening habits consist entirely of Apple Music and Spotify. And then vinyl, like the super old and the, you know, relatively new, and everything in between is a nuisance. But the vinyl gives me that sort of reverent experience I have for albums I've really like repeatedly listened to. And I want to, you know, I want to have the artifact. I want to put it on, and kind of when I listen to vinyl, it's basically the only thing I'm doing. So it's kind of like going to church in a way. And then for everything else, I have my phone just in my earbuds.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the 15 through 19-year-olds don't care about owning music. You know, I think when I was at that age, people would probably spend most of their money, disposable income, on buying music, but it wasn't much. So I don't feel that the trade-off at that age is probably much different financially, because they're probably streaming to a ton of music, you know, streaming a ton of music. And when it's all said and done, they may generate just as much revenue for the business.
Maybe, though, if they're spending $9.99 a month for something. I used to go and spend like $100 a week. You know, I'd save up my tips money from a restaurant job and, you know, blow it all on CDs.
But, I mean, they're not necessarily what they're spending, but what's getting paid out to the industry. So if like some teenagers spending $9.99, but they listen to, you know, thousands and thousands of tracks every month.
I see. They might be generating the same amount of income for artists.
Yes,
I gotcha.
Yes. That's what I meant. That, you know, like when I was that age, it would be like, you know, I probably bought one album a month or, you know, every other week. But interesting stuff happening. Lots of subscribers to Spotify. I think Apple Music was the best thing that ever happened to them. That $9.99 or that 99-cent offer is how they got me at Christmas. But I did just let it lapse, so I'm going to try and re-up for $9.99 for 3 months, see if that works. So, all right, before we go any further, you know, if you've got opinions or thoughts on the change in the market, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or go to our website and leave comments in the show notes. And you can also see the phone number there if you didn't quite catch it just a second ago. And you can weigh in, because we love to hear people's opinions. And we have some questions and stuff later on in the show. So, Chris.
Kevin.
Today we are going to be dealing with criticism, or discussing how to deal with criticism of your music.
I hope we're not going to be dealing with criticism.
I've got my list of critiques for you. Just going to do your performance review on the podcast. So you kind of have some backstory of how this came about, and you wrote an article about it, and it's kind of an interesting thing, especially I think in the era of social media. I think you know, people can really deal with it in the wrong manner, and it can really impact their career in a way that they never expected. So give us the backstory. How did this come about?
Yeah. So, you know, criticism is this thing that is pretty much inevitable when you're making art and putting it out into the world. And yet when it happens, it usually hurts, which is strange. You'd think somehow we'd put up armor or be immune to this and realize that that Abraham Lincoln saying about you can't please all the people all the time would just, you know, we'd feel it's true and just say, you know, our music is for the people that like it and everyone else can, you know, go bury their heads in a hole. But yeah, so it still hurts. And basically what got me thinking about this again was that a snippet of my recent press release for my new album I found online being mocked by a anonymous music critic who has a hilarious blog called Why I Deleted Your Promo Email.tumblr.com.
Yeah.
And basically what that site is, you know, it's an anonymous critic who every day puts a blog entry that is just a small quote from a press release he's received, which is I'm assuming it's a he, but it could be a she. The small part of your press release that basically turned them off so much that they were like, I'm not even listening to this. I'm not reading anymore. So if you go to that site, it's full of a lot of terrible.
When you go to the site, you can see that a lot of them are probably taken from descriptions from press releases. But the one that's on the top right now is Nautical Folk Grog Rockers.
Yes, there's a high level of snark on this blog. But the funny thing is, it's snarky without ever having to say an original word. All he's doing is quoting other people. So anyways, to my horror, something from my press release ended up on there, and which I felt sort of ashamed by in the one thing. And then I got a little annoyed because it's actually the thing that was quoted is actually a quote in the press release. It's not something I was like saying about myself, and it's something that my publicist actually put towards the beginning of the press release because obviously he thought it would, you know, would work on many, you know, getting people interested. So those are two frustrations, and I'm just like, oh no, like the person who actually tipped me off to this was someone who listens to our podcast, and he tweeted and said, hey man, I saw your like tagline on this blog. Oh god, like everyone knows I'm a fraud. So
but yours is not bad compared to what's on this site. It's actually a great site for people to go to and make sure none of these really atrocious sayings are in their press release or in their bio. I think yours, when I read down the list, I think yours is like, oh, whatever, that guy was just being, you know, because the thing is that someone said about you that in like, it wasn't like an album review or something that they called you the Stephen King of folk.
Of indie pop.
Of indie pop, that's right.
Yeah, so, that's you know, not, I've stuck with that and used it quite often, but yeah, so then here it was being mocked in front of everyone, the whole world.
Well, some of these, like, storming a wide array of venues and Renaissance fairs. This is one of them. your new favorite band. That's one that's on here that's, when you read it, it's not as funny, but it's one that when people say about their stuff, it just irritates me. What do you know about what's going to be my new favorite band? I mean, it's just, it's pretentious.
Yeah. And I see that one a lot. But after this whole experience, you know, that night I was kind of bummed and, like I said, feeling a little bit ashamed. And I thought, you know, this – and I actually think the person who tweeted me said this could be the makings of a good podcast episode. And I started thinking that's totally right. Like what we do with those feelings, what we learn from the experience of being kind of publicly criticized, I think it would be valuable for us to unpack in some way. So that was the beginning of this.
Agreed. So this made you start thinking about how artists should deal with criticism. So that's what we're going to talk about. And you have some different steps.
The first thing I think is that bad reviews can be a learning experience. And I remember one of my really early bands when I first moved to Portland put out a record that got really, really terrible reviews. Like, and so bad. Like one review was so bad that, and in a publication that was widely read in the music community, that I was really didn't want to leave the house for weeks. And the very first time I decided I would get up the guts to go out and show my face again, I went to this venue called the White Eagle in Portland. And the first person I saw came up to me and said, "Hey man, sorry about that review." I'm like, "Oh man, you're confirming everything I was afraid of. Like the whole world is laughing at me." So, you know, that's made me feel terrible. And but
what did they say? That was, how did they frame the review?
I can't remember the exact quotes, but basically they were saying it was kind of pretentious and makes all these literary allusions that are either kind of pointless or needlessly go over people's heads, and that the music was, had sort of interesting moments, but was more complex than catchy in a, so basically bored the listeners and, bad thing after bad thing. And then, during this whole period, as I'm feeling ashamed, I'm also feeling like, well, screw them. What do they know? Just went over there, whatever. They didn't get it or something. And then at some point I realized after I'd settled down, I was like, you know what? They're totally right. Like they're being maybe snarky about how they're saying it, but they're totally right. Like I'm an immature songwriter at this point. Like I didn't successfully achieve what I set out to achieve. And I think the reason it stung so much initially is because deep down I knew that, and their criticisms resonated with my fear about my own music. And so basically that helped me make some different decisions and, try some different things creatively, which led me to a period of albums where I felt like I kind of had, it felt more authentic, and I'd sort of discovered the things that I can do well. And so that's my first bit of advice. Like, read the reviews, and once you've settled down a little bit, like, are there bits that feel true? And if so, what can you learn from that? And if there are bits that feel just sort of maybe hurtful, but they're not really cutting you that much, then maybe it's just like you can contextualize that and say, well, that's that person's taste, and they're, not that they're wrong, but their criticism doesn't apply in this situation. So,
So number one, bad reviews can be a learning experience, and it sounds like it was for you.
Yes.
See, they did you a favor. Had you been going along thinking everything was great, you would have been wondering why.
I would have just been creating bland, pretentious music my whole life.
That's true.
Instead of interesting, pretentious music.
So number two, you have bad reviews hurt, so just go ahead and hurt.
Yes. I think another thing that people can do is put up, a real defensive wall and try and avoid it. But it sucks. Like it does hurt when someone tells you they don't like what you've done, especially when generally for musicians, what you're putting out there is the most important thing in your life besides maybe your family or something. It's like it's the thing you care the most about, and it's this in your own mind, you build it up as this sort of ideal version of yourself that you're presenting in some way. And then someone just shits all over it. And of course that means they hate the deepest thing in your soul.
So
go ahead and hurt, have a beer, punch something.
I think this is the thing that's hard for people that aren't creative to understand, or I shouldn't say that aren't creative, because I think most people have some creative tendencies, but where you're trying to create art and put it out into the world, that it's very personal. You've wrestled with it for months and months and months in most cases. It's pulled a lot out of you. Sometimes you've had to put a lot on the line, both financially and emotionally and maybe relationally with the people in your life. And you feel like you've really put yourself out there, and then someone just kind of goes, "Yeah, this sucks." It's like, not only is it hurt because they didn't like your music, but you put a big chunk of your life and a lot of things on the line, and someone just went, "Ah, it sucked. You wasted your time."
And if a lot of people say that it sucks, you have to live with that for a long time, because unlike, if you're playing baseball and you strike out, you'll be up at bat again in like a half hour or whatever. Like, but with an album, it could be a year, two, 3 years before you get another chance to sort of present something and, whatever, make another impression. So, which sucks. Like, you have to live with that kind of reality for a while and not let it, what's the word, derail you so much that you just quit. Because I know, you know, I've had people in my life who've been criticized like that, and then they throw in the towel.
But I like your advice for number two, that just to go ahead and let it hurt, because I think a lot of people try to act like it didn't bother them and just, you know, sort of get defensive towards the reviewer and, you know, kind of playing back into number one. They don't learn anything from it. But you have number three. Always remember that you're not going to be some folks' cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, that's impossible, because if you... You know, my wife doesn't like the Beatles. Like, who the hell doesn't like the Beatles? Like, there is someone
out there. How on earth did you end up marrying that woman? You of all people.
I know. It's bizarre. Opposites attract. But yeah, like, you know, there's niches and specific genres and, you know, everyone has their own taste and there's music to meet that taste, but you can't expect that you're going to put something out and be, you know, the be-all, end-all for everyone. Like, even the most giant pop stars right now, like Katy Perry and Justin Timberlake or whoever else, like Drake, like, there's millions and millions of people who hate them.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift, you know, like, those people have to deal with almost more criticism because the volume of their, you know, all the attention they get and the popularity they have brings all that scrutiny on. And then, so, yeah, the criticism for them is... like a mountain, I'm sure, but they get paid well enough to probably ignore it.
Well, I think there's a couple of good points there. One, you do have to remember that that some people just aren't going to get it. And as the artist who, you know, usually loves their art, there are times when you're like working on an album and there's pieces of the album where, you know, if you've been in a band situation where there's compromise, or when you... or working with a record label where there could be some potentially huge compromise where you, someone may call it out as crap and you're like, yeah, that's what I was telling them in the studio. This is crap. but there are some, a lot of times where you're like, this person obviously just doesn't get us or like what we do. I think those are the ones that I can deal with the most as far as criticism is concerned. If it's like, okay, I get it. This reviewer likes these kind of bands, and that's not who we are. So he's not getting it, or she's not getting it. That's okay, as long as they do it respectfully. And I think I've gotten some reviews where that was the case. And some of the, I think it was the first Christmas album we did with Small Town Poets a few years back. We got a lot of reviews for it, and there was a lot of just like, glowing reviews, and then there was like somebody that was like, meh. And you know, it kind of frustrated me, but at the same time, I reading it is like, oh, this person just doesn't like this kind of stuff. And in fact, I think it was they didn't like Christmas albums. I'm like, why are you reviewing a Christmas record?
Right?
And so that one didn't bother me as much, because I think it's made apparent to the reader that it's not that it's terrible music, it's just it's not my thing. And so that one's easier to deal with. We had sort of a similar review for Hello Morning here in the weekly paper in Portland, where at the time the Portland scene was very folky, kind of indie,
beards and banjos,
and if you recorded it, you know, where everyone was playing together in time, then it was a sellout kind of. That was the kind of vibe. We got a knock in our review for our guitars being so tuned. Not auto-tune, not anything, but like, it sounds like, you know, it sounded too professional is what they said. Like, they tuned their guitars. I'm like, what the, where am I living? That this is something. That one made me mad. But then at the same time, I thought, that almost sounds so ridiculous. I think it makes us look better.
It's like criticizing someone for spelling correctly.
I wouldn't be surprised if that happened these days.
Yeah. Well, you said something that, I thought it was interesting that the person who doesn't like the Christmas music that reviewed your album, you could kind of write them off and not be offended. A lot of times I feel like what happens is we'll get all good press, and then you get one bad review, and that's the one you decide to like really remember and take to heart and focus on. And like, Like, who's that one person that hates you? Like,
where's his address? I'm going to go find him, hunt him down, and make sure that he listens to our record until he loves it.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've talked about this before. Like, you know, like I put out a YouTube video recently. And it's got, you know, I had like 30 likes and one thumbs down. I'm like, who is that asshole?
Who's the person that had nothing better to do than to watch your video and give it a thumbs down?
Right. It's So yeah, I don't know why we give them so much credit or attention in our as we're considering stuff.
I don't have any real stats or data in front of me, but I did read somewhere recently that it takes, you know, like the number of positive comments to outweigh a negative comment, and it's like something like 100 to 1.
This is like in sort of general psychological.
Yeah, in
terms.
General, yeah, yeah. It was something like that. Like it takes a lot of, like if someone says something that really hurtful, it takes a lot of positivity to overcome that. And that's probably part of the psychology playing into this. It's that, you know, there's 5 glowing reviews and then one person just craps all over it, and it's like it feels the pain you feel does not. Is not outweighed by the joy you felt from the other reviews. So,
right.
So I'm sure that has something to do with it.
Yeah. When really I feel like obviously good reviews feel great. Feels great to be understood. But if you're going to be suspicious of the negative ones, you should probably be equally suspicious of the positive ones, you know, especially if the good review like really closely mirrors your press release. Chances are that person didn't like love your music to dive into it and write, you know, some long thing that, out of their own minds. So,
yeah, I mean, that's
maybe that, ignore all reviews in a way.
That's one of my biggest frustrations about album reviews in general. It's like I was looking at some this week. You can tell an album reviewer doesn't like your record but may not want to say it when they just start basically telling people what's on the record. Like track number 2 is an upbeat number titled this, and then it dives into a mellow mode of track number 3, and there's an extended guitar solo. When they start doing stuff like that, that means they're not really into it. And sometimes you can tell that even though they may give it 5 stars, they write the review like that. I'm like, this person didn't really like that album, but the band has a certain status that they didn't want to offend the band, or they were just kind of on a bandwagon.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think when you were also talking about sort of contextualizing reviews based on who's writing them, if there's a sort of like a genre blog or publication that gives your album a bad review, it hurts more because that's a person who's a sort of expert in your music, as opposed to someone who's a kind of general music critic who might write about folk and death metal and rap and whatever. Like because then you have no frame of reference for what they're even into. So
yeah,
I guess it's easier to sort of discount those reviews. But yeah, should we move on to the fourth point? Bad reviews can boost your website's SEO power.
Yep, they can.
So like if you get lucky enough to have a Rolling Stone review and they crap all over your record and they link back to your website, then in a year, you're still going to get all of that SEO power from that link to your website, and that review will be buried on their site and hopefully it will never appear on your site. So there you go.
And
in a way, it's helping you.
For those that don't know, SEO is search engine optimization. Basically, you know, when Google is trying to decide what people were searching for, they rank websites by various things. So if a very popular website like Rolling Stone is linking to your official website, then Google looks at that and goes, oh, this website is of higher importance than these other websites because this big website's linking to it. And so if you get a bad review on Pitchfork or some popular websites, it can still boost that power because Google doesn't know the review's negative. It just knows that all these websites are linking to this page. So that could come into play for you, you know, beyond just searches for your artist name, if you've got some, you know, confusion in the marketplace where there's other bands like you, it could help you, similar names, it could help you bubble up to the top. But it could also be like if you've got indications of the music scene you're in, like here in Portland, Oregon, if I have on our bio like Portland, Oregon music, whatever, you know, those keywords, when people search Portland, Oregon music, my band might come to the top because these big websites are linking to it. So that's where it could be an advantage to you. I wouldn't put negative reviews on my website. But, you know, if Rolling Stone did review your album, it might be good to include an excerpt that at least makes it sound like they validated the fact that you exist.
Like, quote, this is music, .. End quote.
A new release from a band from Portland, Rolling Stone.
That's funny when, you know, like films do that a lot.
All the time. And it's I'm sure it drives reviewers crazy because I'm sure they'll write just some terrible review and they take some three-word excerpt and put it on the movie poster and saying, it's an adventure, you know, it's something like that just...
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, the sort of indie music world it feels a lot smaller than that. But I would never do that to someone who had sort of, you know, gave me an average or poor review of something, and then to kind of twist their words. I'd be so afraid that they would see that and be like, "Dude, what the hell are you doing?"
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I know they're busy. I know they're not checking up on every musician's how they spin their reviews.
Yeah. All right. The next one, number five. Remember your manners.
Yeah, I think maybe this is one of the most important ones. And a few years ago in Portland, Oregon, there was a band that got kind of trashed by, I think it might have been the Willamette Week. I can't remember. But a local weekly gave them a very bad review.
That's kind of a rite of passage here in town. If those folks trash your record.
Or the Mercury, you know, they're both good at it. But this band kind of took it upon themselves to retaliate and write a comment back that was criticizing the publication and the critic, and it backfired because not only did obviously the publication and the writer take offense, but the whole music community was kind of ganging up on them and be like, "Don't treat someone like this who took the time to listen to and write about your music," because like a lot of people don't even get that opportunity to have their music considered in such a way. So, you know, keep your mouth shut. And I think the band retracted it and might have felt bad about it. But yeah, that's like the worst thing you can do, because all these, you know, that publication is probably either not going to write about a future release of yours if you retaliate, or they will write about it and they'll keep shitting on you. And all other writers and industry people in the town see that, and what they see is, oh, you're just a defensive artist. You're probably difficult to work with, like, and then suddenly your opportunities start shrinking. So that's my
summary. I think this is, in the age of social media, this is one where you can really, really, in a matter of a day, annihilate your career, and it's happened a lot. Both at the top and in the, you know, top meaning like major label artists doing it, or, you know, independent artists doing it like this manners as well, where you can just really destroy your career by getting online and just saying stuff that you just should not be saying. So yeah, never call out a reviewer. I think it's okay to contact a reviewer, take a few days, you know, take a few deep breaths. But I think it's okay to contact a reviewer that gave you a bad review and ask them some follow-up questions, you know, in the sense that you're respecting their authority as their position as an album reviewer. Hopefully that they have some sort of qualifications that they're doing that. But call them up, email them, ask them some follow-up questions. You know, start trying to use it as a way to build a relationship with them. And then next time around, they'll probably be looking forward to your release and be wanting to review it. You don't want them to be looking forward to your release so they can just trash it again, which I've seen that happen. here in town where there was like a band that had a bad reputation and people were like, oh, I'm gonna review this record.
And I can't wait to ask you who that is after the podcast is over.
I can't remember who their name is because it was quite a while ago, but I remember, I think it was around the time when I first started working at CD Baby, and we had some folks here that were also doing writing for some of these publications and hearing about that then. But it's like, you want to be that, you know, because that will happen. They'll either never review it again or they'll be have such blinders on that they won't take your music seriously. And even if it's a great album, they're going to say bad stuff about it. So, you know, just understand that, you know, they've got a bullhorn and a publication or a website or some manner of a platform that, you know, they can speak about your music. And you just need to understand that if they say stuff you don't like, that you're just going to have to deal. So try to make it a positive thing where you can reach out to the reviewer or whoever it was and start a dialogue, ask follow-up questions, be polite.
I have a story that happened just yesterday, which demonstrates the ease in which you can put your foot in your mouth with social media. And so, you know, like I've gotten a lot of good reviews for my new album. And then yesterday, a friend of mine took a picture of a review I got in a magazine called Dispatch, which is a Portland, Maine-based magazine, but they cover the whole state. So it's like, you know, and it's sort of everywhere. It's a big music and culture magazine. Anyway, she saw that I had a review in that and she took a picture of it and she sent it to me because she was just so excited that it was in there. And she didn't read the review first. So I was like, oh, cool. Like, let me look at it. So I blew the picture up on my screen and I read it. And, you know, I can't say it was a terrible review, but there were a few like zingers in it that kind of stung. So at first I was like, why did she share this with me? Like, cause she said like, look what I found in Dispatch, like all excited. Why did she share this? So all I wrote on the, I just responded on Facebook and I said, ouch. And then like 5 minutes later, I realized that the music reviewer liked my comment. And then I thought, oh no, like what happened? Like, so I went back to my friend's comment on my wall with the picture and I realized that she had tagged me and the writer in that because she was also friends with the journalist. And so then I'm like, oh no, I felt like a jerk because had I known she was tagged on the post or that she was even a friend with my friend, I would not have said that because I immediately thought, oh no, it's like I'm putting the critic on the hook for sort of justifying her opinions, which I would never have done had I known she would ever see that. And then the very next thing, she wrote a very long and very kind response about, and you know, basically it ended with saying like, you know, if I didn't like it, you would really know. Like, I guess meaning like it would be very obvious that she hated it. But anyways, I felt totally awkward and terrible because the last thing I would ever want to do is make someone feel like they have to justify their writing to me or to anyone in another forum besides the magazine they're writing for. So that was awkward.
Yeah.
So check who's tagged in your Facebook post, I guess is the lesson. But it kind of plays into my next point on this list, which is number 6, you'll seem cool and confident by staying calm. I think when I wrote to my friend and said, ouch, that was my version of trying to look like calm. Like I'm willing to admit there was a few you know, critiques in there that stung, but like overall, whatever, that's cool. Like I'm willing to just say, ouch, and move on. But then the other, you know, details of the situation made it more awkward. But, you know, I think if you can kind of blow these things off, let them roll off your shoulder or share them with your fan base in a way that's more like good natured, good humored instead of defensive, then, you know, you'll seem unfazed and your audience and other people will assume that your music is all that much better because you believe in it that much.
Yeah, I think it's okay to acknowledge a bad review online without looking like you're trying to, you know, start a fight online. I think, you know, like posting a photo like you did and maybe a way that might have come off differently. But, first off, knowing that the person was tagged in it, I would have not posted with the journalist tagged in it. But you know, if you post a review that you know is not great and online, you could say something like, "Hey, do you guys agree with this review?" But then, but I take that back, because if everyone in your fans say, "Yeah, I totally agree, they're right, your album sucks," no,
yeah,
it's weird.
I mean, with the situation that happened to me is, you know, ultimately I realized that she's friends with my friend. I'm, you know, so I just friended her on Facebook and I wrote her like saying, like, you know, I appreciate you giving my album the attention and putting in Dispatch, and you know, we had a very fine conversation after that point, which, you know, so I don't think there was any harm done on either side, really. But yeah, when my friend shared it, I'm like, why did you share this so excitedly? Like, did you read it? And then she said later, she's like, no, I didn't even read it. I just thought it was so cool that you were in there. I have never shared a bad review, I don't think, with my, like, on Facebook or on email or anything, and invited any kind of fan base response. Like,
well, but after I said that, a couple things came to mind. One, you can share bad reviews because, like you just said, people aren't reading them.
all that sunk in was that my picture and my album cover was in this magazine.
So
that
Rolling Stone could just trash your album, but you post on social media, my album got reviewed in Rolling Stone, and everyone's like, sure, woohoo, and nobody even takes the time to read it.
So, and make sure the picture you take of the page has all the words tiny and blurry.
Yeah.
So that no one can even blow it up and read it.
But the other thing is, this is something that kind of goes back to number five, is never, ever, ever sick your fans on people. It's ridiculous. And there's one thing to deal with an artist that's frustrated and kind of being not minding their manners online. But when you start trolling people, that takes it to a whole new level and you will just be blacklisted. Do not do that. It's very tempting, and artists do it all the time. It happens from time to time here at CD Baby over the most ridiculous things. And you start putting your fans involved in a situation they don't understand what they're doing. They think they're helping you out, and they're really just making you look really, really unprofessional. And so don't do that. Please don't do that. If your fans naturally chime in and speak up and defend you, that's cool, but don't instigate riots.
You know what? Now we're coming to the end of these tips. I'm realizing that we've been focusing really heavily on, like, you know, music reviews and the sort of journalism aspect of it, but criticism and negative feedback can come in all sorts of different ways. You know, it could be a YouTube comment. It could be someone who just consistently ignores you when you're trying to, you know, book a show at their venue. That's a sort of implicit criticism, I guess. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of ways that people can basically give you the message they don't like you or your music. So I think these tips can apply in most of those situations.
And the thing I'd sum up with is that no one is going to like your music more than you. So in most cases, no one's going to feel as passionately about it as you, I will say. And so you got to understand that you already have a heightened awareness about your music and what you're doing and your belief in it. And, you know, you got to understand that people aren't approaching it in the same way. And it's funny because I was listening to a new album this week, and I had seen someone, one of the crew members, months ago, post online that it was by far this band's best album ever and just all this raving about it. And I listened to it, and frankly, I thought it was their worst album they've done. and I was kind of reflecting. I was like, how is it that we're seeing it so differently? And it's someone who's very close to the situation. They're working for that group. They feel very connected to it. They're not the artist themselves, but this person that's the crew member is also an artist and has some musical endeavors of their own. So I know they feel very close and to the situation, and things when you get away from that just strike people differently, and it sometimes it takes a while to even figure out how that's going to be because you're so close to it. You know, every time I release an album, every time I talk to someone releasing an album, they're like, if everyone just hears it, I know they'll love it. And I'm like, I understand the passion because I feel the same way about my music, but at the end of the day, it's just not true. So you got to kind of temper your expectations for that.
It's almost the recording equivalent, or the songwriting or recording equivalent of that thing that happens when you're on stage and you make a little move and you think you've basically done like the greatest, most glorious rock leap. And really, like, if you watched it back on a video, it's like you jumped like 2 inches off the ground.
Yeah.
Everything feels more dramatic. You're attached to everything more. You have a higher opinion of yourself than others will.
Plus, you really feel like on stage you're putting yourself out there, and so everything feels bigger than it is. And sometimes reality can sting a little. Well, if you've had a bad review and had an experience relating to that, how you coped with it, maybe an exchange you had with the reviewer, I would love to hear about it. Our listener line is 360-524-2209. If you'd like to share a line from a review, that would be funny too. If there was a funny line, I'll have to go dig up that review that where they made a jab at us for tuning our guitars and post that in the comments. But I think it'd be very entertaining for people to post their reviews. It'd be therapy. We can all
therapy, yeah.
Share our bad reviews, have a good cry, a good laugh, and know that we're all going to be okay.
And especially stories that involve you following up in some way that either made it way worse for you or that actually made it better. And maybe you formed a relationship with this reviewer and somehow that led to good things. So if it diverged into the terrible or the amazing, those stories would be awesome too.
And we kind of referenced album reviews a lot, but there are so many different kinds of reviews that happens, whether it's a show review. If you've had a live show reviewed, they do that a lot of times, depending on what your local media does. A lot of times they'll do that, find a show to review or do a preview of, which like an album release show. A lot of times I know the local papers here will do like an album release show preview where it's kind of an album review, kind of artist review, you know. So any kind of review or critique, whether it's DJ, internet radio, whoever, it'd be fun to share. 360-524-2209, or you can weigh in at the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com, or you can email them to us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And speaking of feedback, I've got a couple questions before we close out the show. People emailed us.
Oh, no phone calls this week?
Nope, no phone calls, but some questions, some good ones. So let's get to the emails. This is from Allie, and she said, "Hello, dear Kevin." I like this one already. "Hello, dear Kevin. I really like these
last..." Hello, dear Kevin. You suck.
You suck. That's right. We've gotten a few critiques about the podcast, let me tell you. "Hello, dear Kevin. I really liked these last episodes, especially six tips for making music videos with no budget. Here's my question. I used some royalty-free loops in my songs, and I was about to submit my album for publishing, but before that, I Shazammed all my beats and found a song that the melody was exactly like my song, but arrangement and other parts of the song, like drums, were different. Basically, he and I used the same loop, and now I don't know if I could publish the song or not. If I do publish, will I get in trouble? By the way, I'm introducing CD Baby to all my friends to use your service for publishing their music," and so forth. So thank you for the email, Ali. Let's see, I think he's from Afghanistan. We have a very international audience. I will say, if you are using free, royalty-free loops, I would say it's best to not do that. And I emailed Ali back to tell them, don't use royalty-free loops if you don't need to, because lots of people are using them. In the digital space, it becomes very challenging with all the different kind of fingerprinting and recognition software that's being used, especially on YouTube. Trouble on YouTube. You will not be able to monetize your stuff on YouTube. It'll just be in conflict with everybody. this really happened a lot when they first started the YouTube Content ID program with loops that were in GarageBand, the software that comes on a Mac. So many artists were using the drum loops off of that, and it was considering all the songs the same, because I guess the drum beat and how it senses the drums is a pretty key component in identifying tracks. And so that was throwing a lot of things in conflict. I think you don't hear about that much anymore, because I think they pretty much won't monetize any of the, like, they've cataloged all the stuff that's in GarageBand, and they won't monetize anything that, that recognizes as a GarageBand loop. So try to stay away from that. You know, as far as distributing it, if it's a royalty-free loop, I would, if it's very much a royalty-free, you can have this, you can do with it what you want, you can sell it, you can do whatever, then you can distribute it. That's not a problem. But you'll just run into those issues that get irritating with, like, the Content ID stuff and any sort of audio matching software.
Yeah, and in terms of publishing, I mean, the underlying composition can still be, you know, you can still be the publisher of that. It's just sort of the sound recording with that loop on it that becomes the issue.
Yeah, and I think in this case, when you the reference to publishing meant distribution is what was being talked about. But yes, you are correct. You are correct. Well, thanks for the email, Ali. Let's see. I've got one more. This is from Dan. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for your interview with Kathy Heller. I've run into her on a few other music business podcasts, and I appreciate the way you pushed for detail on the way she's made licensing work for her. Sorry for the lengthy question. I've got a few TV syncs as well as a national ad, and I'm working on expanding that, but there continues to be one thing I haven't heard her tackle yet, and maybe because it's a question pretty far along the path that won't apply to most people. She talks about how she made the switch from using a licensing agent to advocating for herself, and talks extensively about contacting music supervisors for TV placements. But she also makes it clear that she doesn't have that much interest in TV, and all her focus is on advertising. So I'm wondering who she contacts and how she approaches those clients when she doesn't work through a jingle house or music agency. For example, I'm guessing she doesn't call Nike directly for a spot. Is it a creative director at their agency who fields that? If you have any insights or follow-up, I'd be so curious. Thanks for your time and your work, Dan. I actually checked out Dan's website. He's had some nice placements. To answer his question, it could be both. A company like Nike, which happens to be here in Portland, Oregon, and I know this to be 100% true, they have an in-house music supervisor, but they also have a advertising agency called Wieden & Kennedy, which is also here in Portland, that handles some of their campaigns. So if you see some big national spot, like the Nike spot that happens during the Olympics coming up, that's probably handled by Wieden & Kennedy, their advertising agency. And they'll have a separate music supervisor. So they'll have in-house music people there as well. And depending on the size of a advertising agency, it could be there could be a lot of music folks inside the building. But going back to the Nike side of it, like I said, they have a music person in-house as well. And they tend to focus on things that are more of like shorter promotions, maybe some one-off things, some special projects, maybe a tie-in with like a company like Spotify or something like that, where music gets used, they'll come into play, or web ads or something like that. But they could be involved at the big national spot as well. So they have both a lot of times. So to answer your question, it might be worth trying to find the person at a place like Nike and asking them directly, talking to them directly. But it's also still worth it to reach out to the advertising agencies that these companies use. Now, most companies, even just because they're big, doesn't mean they have an in-house person like the guy at Nike. It really depends on the type of work they do. Like a giant financial institution that is a massive company has an advertising agency working for them, probably doesn't have an in-house music person because they're not doing like web stuff. They're not doing like, you know, stuff in pop culture and things like that. But they'll still have a big, you know, ad agency working for them that has a music person that's probably selecting music for their ads. So it can be both. I think hunting down music supervisors at advertising agencies seems to be the hardest one to do. You can find them online. Sometimes there's directories out there that you can buy that has their information. But, you know, back in the day when I was doing pitching for CD Baby for Sync placements, those were the folks that would hardly ever respond to an email, where it seemed like with TV was the easiest to get someone to respond to an email and start, you know, being interested in the music that we had. Film is a little bit more challenging than TV, but also film is very cyclical. Like, they'll, you know, a music supervisor will have a very specific project that's going to last a year, and so they may or may not need any music. But then
they might need some of that medieval times music that we were talking about from that Tumblr blog.
Exactly. Actually, that's how, you know, for a while we were getting a lot of calls at CD Baby, you know, back in the day, from music supervisors trying to license stuff because they'd find really odd or unique, I should say, tracks at our website and want to license it for various things. So TV commercials do pay the most. That's why Kathy focuses on that, because you could get one placement and it could be $80,000. In fact, there's a band from Portland. This was probably about seven, eight years ago. They were placed in, somebody here at CD Baby was their label. They got a placement in a Target ad, and I believe the initial sync fee was like $80,000. But then Target relicensed it for some national spots. Or no, it got licensed by IBM, and IBM licensed it for the U.S., and I think they got another serious check like that. And then IBM licensed it again to go international. And I think all in all, from licensing for like three or four commercial spots, they ended up making like $250,000. So that's serious cash for some placements if you can get them. Where TV, you're going to get like $2,000 for a independent artist track in a background slot on broadcast TV. So that's why Kathy focuses on the big fish, because she could get TV placements all day. It's just a lot more work for her to administer all that. And if she has a licensing company working for her, they can handle that stuff, and she can focus on writing for commercials. Did anything I say make sense, Chris?
It all made sense.
Okay.
It was a thorough answer.
Okay.
I thought it was good.
Okay. Good. Well, thanks for the email.
I approve of your answer.
Okay. I won't edit it out then.
No criticism from me.
That's right. Because if someone criticizes me, I'm going to cry myself to sleep tonight. Cool. Well, thanks for the emails. It's always good to get questions. People were really diving into that last episode. I'm glad there was people found it very inspiring, as I did as well. It was great to hear Kathy speak. And so if you have any other questions or comments, 360-524-2209, podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or leave a question or comment in the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. I think that's going to do it, Chris.
Should we conclude on a down note?
Oh, yes. Yes. In all seriousness, we did have some very sad news for the CD Baby podcast community. Longtime friend of the podcast, Lisa Lapine, who we've referenced many, many times over the course of this podcast. She was, what episode was she on?
She was the second episode, and she was our very first guest.
Yes, and she's been sort of a mentor to both of us in various ways, and to pretty much everyone who's attempted to pursue music in Portland knows of Lisa Lapine. And a couple weeks ago, she passed away with cancer, and we were very sad. And yeah, so we've mentioned her a lot, and she was actually slotted to speak at this upcoming DIY musician conference in Chicago. And so Chris and I were going to try and carry the torch. You actually had done some, had a conversation with her.
I talked to her a couple, like the week before she died. Basically, she got diagnosed with cancer and then went and got surgery for that. And had, you know, sort of rigorous treatments planned over the next 6 months, but the surgery was not supposed to be all that threatening, but she died from complications of that. So it was the sort of the diagnosis of cancer was a shock, but then her passing so quickly after that was even more of a shock. And I had just talked to her the week before, kind of brainstorming ideas and exercises and things we can do for her seminar at the conference. And yeah, so it's sad on many levels. She was a really, really amazing, unique person. She was very fearless.
Yeah. I when I first met Lisa, I thought her approach to everything was very refreshing, and she's one of the person who talked about defining who you are, what your story is, and that being such a key point in how you pursue your music. And that always stuck with me. We reference it constantly in the podcast. I reference it constantly when I'm talking to artists, and it really comes from kind of those conversations with Lisa, and she will be missed. And yeah, it's very sad. We were going to try and, you know, when we found out she couldn't come to the conference because of the diagnosis of cancer, we were wanting to still incorporate her in some way and include her. And she was helping us kind of outline some things to do. And we're going to carry on and still do what we had planned and incorporate her like we had planned. And, she gave us some good advice how to make it interactive and I think very engaging, but she will be missed. And we thought about, well, do we share this with the podcast community? Do we not? But I felt like it'd be awkward for us not to, with the amount of times we've referenced her over the years of doing this podcast.
And yeah. So, I mean, I think just one more fact about her that I think really made her special in terms of the marketing world is she had a background in promotion and marketing and stuff, which I think a lot of people imagine as, you know, white men in ties and
power suits.
Yeah. You know, that's a very particular way of that people think about marketing. And she, you know, she was versed in that, but she also had this. Well, she loved music a ton, but she also was really into myth and Jungian psychology and, you know, sort of this almost the opposite of what most people would think of marketing. And she was able to kind of meld them so that marketing and, well, promotion really for her wasn't, you know, just about what can I get for myself? What can I get for my music? It was about like promotion was a growth experience. It was moving yourself forward. And so much of that had to do with story and authenticity and all these, you know, these sort of good artistic qualities. So, yeah, she will be very missed.
Yeah, she was very interested in connecting people. And I think that's where I think so many people appreciated her. She would, you know, have a conversation with you and be like, you know who you need to meet. And she would hook you up with people that there was a mutually beneficial relationship as far as like, oh, you know, because when I met her, we were just trying to get this podcast off the ground. And she was like, you know who you need to meet? You need this person, this person. They're all trying to do similar things and you should know each other and collaborate and just learn from each other. And so that looking at all the posts on Facebook and people talking about her, that's one thing that pretty much everybody mentioned. And
matchmaker. Yeah.
So she will be missed.
I wrote a yesterday I put it up on the DIY Musician blog, an article called 10 music marketing lessons I learned from Lisa Lapine. And a lot of it is stuff she talked about in that podcast episode, but with a little extra commentary from me. But that was my tribute to her.
Yeah. So check that out. And, it was just very sad and sudden. And, you know, we just wanted to pass word along because it is really, she's woven herself into the DNA of this podcast and a lot of what I've done and how I communicate with artists. And so, and I know been very influential in Chris's career and a lot of artists here in Portland, Oregon. So it's always sad to see when someone passes like that. So, well,
I don't know how to close out from that.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just say, go back and listen to episode number 2.
Yeah. Go number 2. It's been there. We still get lots of comments about it. I think it's one of those timeless episodes. And
except for the fact that we mentioned MySpace a lot.
That's true. Hey, I'm still holding on to my MySpace. Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, yeah, timeless. So, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. We will be back soon with more, and we'll catch you later.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.